UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And I'm with Douglas Durman from Philadelphia, who is the Vice President of the Institute for Achievement of Human Potential. It is celebrating its 61st year, and it's so innovative, although it's 61 years. I'm going to be talking to Douglas, whose father actually started this institute in 1955, and he wrote the book How to Teach Children How to Read in 1963, which became a national bestseller at that time.
Yes,
What's the name of the book?
How to Teach Your Baby to Read.
Yeah.
And here in Britain, it's Teach Your Baby to Read.
Well, why was that necessary, you know, in 1963 to write that book?
Well, I mean, it was a wildly radical book.
Yes.
And it's still, you know, considered a radical idea to teach babies how to read. When we talk about babies, we mean babies.
Really?
We teach babies how to read.
What do you mean by a baby? Like what age?
A couple of months of age.
You must be joking.
No, I'm absolutely sincere. My sister, Janet Doman, the CEO of the Institute, wrote a book which is called, in English, How Smart Is My Baby? Hmm. And this is basically a Bible in child brain development from birth to 12 months of age for average babies. So it's a true 21st century book because it teaches the parents how they can evaluate their children neurologically, place them on our developmental profile, and then construct a visual, auditory, tactile program and a motor program of mobility, language, and manual competence to get the baby to advance quickly and rapidly.
Wow. So I'd just like to clarify to my listeners that when Douglas and Douglas' father, Glenn Doman, were looking at how to teach babies to read, they were not really looking at how to make children more intelligent and be extremely smart so they are high achievers, but actually their philosophy is you can influence your children's brains positively. And their work has been about helping children with brain damage or brain injury, and 25,000 children and adults with brain injury have gone through their program. Before I get into what's your philosophy, how do you work, what's the science behind it, what you are doing, tell me a little bit about, because it's been 61 years, any interesting stories about who have gone through this program and have really achieved Would you have some examples?
Oh, well, you know, we just came from our institute in Europe, in Italy, in Tuscany, and we've saw children from all over Europe, as we do twice a year when we are at our European institute. And we saw a little girl from Spain, 4 years of age, Down syndrome. She has been on our program since she was a baby. She is four. She reads independently.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, I mean, average children don't read independently until they're six, if they're lucky.
And this is a girl with Down syndrome.
With Down syndrome. And, of course, you know, they were called mongoloid idiots. I mean, you only have to go back 50 years ago that such children were called.
And they were labeled.
The medical diagnosis was mongoloid idiot, which, of course, is a heresy for these children that have tremendous potential. So this little girl could read like an eight-year-old, even though she's four, showing how intelligent these children can be. Her math is better than an average six-year-old. Her general knowledge is superior to an average six-year-old. She can run hundreds of meters nonstop. She can brachiate. You know, brachiation is traveling hand over hand on an overhead ladder with your feet off the ground. So she can brachiate independently, which requires great manual competence.
Okay, let me get this right. Has she been wrongly diagnosed with Down syndrome?
No. She's definitely been correctly diagnosed with Down syndrome.
So she is a child prodigy?
No, she is an excellent result.
How does that happen? This is what I'm interested in. You know, as medical researchers and practitioners, we just kind of think that actually you cannot influence the brain development, particularly in a baby or a child with brain damage. But you are saying they can produce extraordinary results. There must be some science behind it. So what is the science that informs you that actually it is possible to train a baby with Down syndrome to achieve what you're talking about?
Right. So I mentioned to you that the Institute's work began right after the Second World War, when my father, the founder, a physical therapist, and the original team of staff used conventional therapy, speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy, but not drug therapy. And they treated brain-injured children with all their hearts and all their souls, and the results were not significant.
Mm-hmm.
And they realized that they weren't significant because they were treating the symptoms. And
uh-huh.
the problem and the reason why the basic conventional therapy is doomed to fail is that it is based on the symptoms. And so they did a study.
Symptoms as in epilepsy, fits,
right?
Or
epilepsy is a symptom of brain injury.
Okay.
Paralysis is a symptom of brain injury. Blindness, you know, of course, there is eye blindness.
Yes.
But the great most blindness is brain blindness. There's nothing wrong with the eyeballs at all.
Right.
The problem is in the central nervous system. So the treating of the symptoms doesn't work. We proved that right after the Second World War.
So you're saying that, you know, by giving an anti-epileptic to a baby with these symptoms is not the solution?
I mean, it's a scandalous situation. It is a scandalous situation. Babies come to us and they are addicted to anticonvulsant medications. Often they're amphetamines, so the same drugs that people get arrested for selling on the street are being used to brain injured children. And by the way, we predicted this 50 years ago when we started our detoxification program. Our medical staff carefully detoxifies with a protocol that we've worked out over 50 years and slowly and carefully withdraws the anticonvulsant medications. Now, just a couple of examples. We have had hundreds of children that the last time they ever had a seizure was the last day they were ever given anticonvulsant medications. Now, if you saw that a couple of times, it would be interesting. But when you've seen it as many times as we have seen it, you have to ask yourself, is it possible?
Yes, that's the question. How is that possible?
That the anticonvulsant medication is actually giving them seizures. Other examples, we have some children that the last time they had a seizure was the last time their mothers fed them cow milk. And right. Literally, as soon as cow milk was stopped, the children stopped having seizures. So if you saw that a couple times, it would be interesting, but then you have to ask, is the cow's milk somehow helping the brain to function more poorly, and then the result is the symptom of
a
seizure.
I'll come back to that. I'll definitely come back to, you know, foods that contain gluten, that contains casein or particular type of casein, maybe in one particular breed of cow's milk, and what about sheep's milk and those aspects. Although I know, Douglas, your entire family have dedicated their life to this fantastic program, and you are specialized in mobility-related areas. So I won't ask you too many tricky questions about nutrition.
Okay. Well.
But that's an interesting, you know, that's a very important aspect, because it's not about drugs, it's about nutrition. Because it's the nutrition that helps in the development of the baby. But coming back to...
Well, if I can just interrupt to say that part of the protocol is that to reduce the medications and take the child off of the anticonvulsant medications, the nutritional program has to be in place.
Right.
And of course, that means gluten and dairy are, you know, removed from the diet entirely.
Yes, yeah, that makes total sense. So in terms of, you know, supporting babies to develop, actually not just to become average, but to be brilliant, you must then have an understanding about brain development that's different from the mainstream understanding.
Yes, and that is
and
that...
what is that, you know?
Well,
what's
children,
the premise?
Well, certainly that brain-injured people, and particularly brain-injured children, have incredible potential that is not understood and is ignored. And these children are considered hopeless. They are not. And then in terms of our work with well babies, that well babies have, again, incredible potential that is being ignored. Our work is about teaching parents of well babies and brain injured children how they can develop their children at home. But, you know, going back to your original question, you know, when we started to develop methods treating the brain itself, before we could do that, my father said, we can't treat brain-injured children properly if we don't know about well children. So we have to study well children to find out what is necessary in their development.
Yes.
That we then need to reproduce with our brain-injured children. So in 1964, my father developed the Institute's developmental profile. And this is a developmental profile from birth to age six. Mm-hmm. And the human brain basically is done its growth, its quantitative growth, by the age of six.
Right.
So from birth, the baby skyrockets up to age six. And then at six, brain growth and development really levels off, and it's qualitative development after that standpoint. So our developmental profile has 21 blocks about what the children have to do from a sensory standpoint in terms of complete visual development, complete auditory development, complete tactile development. Mm-hmm. 21 different abilities that they need to do. And this is done in hierarchy from birth to age six. Mm-hmm. And then in mobility, 21 mobility language manual competence functions that are essential mm-hmm. for children to be fully developed. So brain injured children are put on that developmental profile. It tells us what their neurological age is, and then we compare that to their chronological age. So if a brain injured child is 72 months of age, chronologically, mm-hmm. his neurological age is 36 months, then he has a growth rate of 50% of an average child the same age.
So, Douglas, you're not talking about the mental age.
We're talking about the neurological age.
So what's the difference? Because I'm sure quite a few of my listeners would have heard of the term the mental age of the child is lesser than the chronological age, but they may not be familiar with what is meant by neurological age of a child.
Right. Well, I mean, because it starts with a newborn, I mean, most people wouldn't think of a mental age for a newborn or a two-month-old or even for a seven-month-old.
Exactly, yeah.
But this is neurological development that the child has to take place. My father was a purist in terms of brain function. And he said, you know, we know a lot about the brain, and there's a lot that can be done to develop the brain. He said, however, our work is not in the mind. You know, there are other people. Mm-hmm. And, of course, this gets sticky in that, you know, brain-injured children have been called mentally retarded.
Yes.
Now, this is a phrase that we have fought against for 50 years, mm-hmm. you know, to get that erased from the medical jargon. Because what does mental retardation mean? It really means stupid.
Yes.
That's what everybody thinks. And, of course, it's such a pejorative term that now, you know, pop culture talks about people being retards, or children yes. call each other retards. I mean, this is terrible. And with brain-injured children, one of the first things that my father determined was that they were very intelligent mm-hmm. and not mentally retarded. And that's, you know, why we have fought that term. So from a mental standpoint, mm-hmm. You know, brain-injured children are also considered to have psychological problems. Well, yeah. 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds don't have enough experience in life to see the difference between the way things are and they should be, and
yes.
then have emotional problems as a result of that. So in the book, What to Do About Your Brain-Injured Child, which was the first book that my father wrote for the parents of brain-injured children, he explains in there that psychological problems are not a factor for little brain-injured children. It's a problem for 14, 18, 22-year-old brain-injured people, where they've had enough of a life to see that their brothers and sisters have succeeded
yeah.
and they are not succeeding. And yes, that lays the foundation for emotional and psychological problems. But
yeah.
the only way to solve that is to develop them and make the problems go away.
Right.
I mean, there's no way to solve that other than making the neurological problem go away, which is what our program is all about.
Wow. So in a way, it to me looks like if we start to look at children from an adult brain perspective, we are going to get it wrong.
Right.
So it's really important to understand development as it is, which is probably what your program does. So, Douglas, I know you're not a medical doctor or a medical researcher, but because you have been with this program all your life, really, because you grew up as an infant, you grew up in where your father was running this, and then you studied at the university and came back and took up this program. Would you be able to, for me as a doctor, I'm really interested in understanding how you relate the various parts of the brains and what these different parts of the brain determine in terms of a child's development?
Well, we were talking before about, you know, children that are called cerebral palsy.
Mm-hmm.
This is another term that we have been very much opposed to.
Uh-huh.
Well, Dr. Fay, more than 70 years. Well, Dr. Fay was part, he was a founding member of United Cerebral Palsy. He was a founding member of the first organization, and I think in the history of the world, that actually considered itself dedicated to the children who are called cerebral palsy. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Fay said to his medical colleagues, he said, gentlemen, we've got it wrong. And because in those days, there were only men that were on the board of such organizations, not women. And of course, when you're talking about children, you should have women involved in what's going on.
Makes sense.
And that's why the majority of the staff in the institutes are females. Right. And that's, of course, it is an organization of women, about of women, for women and children. So with the...
you were talking about cerebral palsy.
Yeah. So Dr. Fay said, first of all, cerebral refers to the cerebrum, which is the highest level of the brain.
Yeah.
But children who have cerebral palsy are injured in the midbrain and the subcortical areas of the brain. So he said, first of all, we've got the wrong part of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And then palsy. Palsy means shaking or paralyzed.
Yeah.
Well, the human brain has no moving parts. It cannot shake. It cannot be paralyzed.
Yeah.
He said these words are wrong, and they ignored him. And so now millions and millions of dollars have been spent on cerebral palsy children, not making them any significantly better.
Right.
So my father, in the 1960s, began to teach the parents of these children how to teach them to read.
Mm-hmm.
So our whole program of early reading started with brain-injured children.
Mm-hmm.
And the children who have cerebral palsy or injured in the midbrain, they have significant visual problems. For example, because the midbrain is responsible for depth perception and the ability to converge both at far point and near point, these children can't see the way that you and I do. So to teach them to read, we had to give them big words.
Right.
And so if the word is big enough, they can see it in spite of their convergence problem.
Yeah.
But they learn like that.
Yes.
And he learned that they learn very rapidly. And so in the early 1960s, we had hundreds of cerebral palsy 2-, 3-, and 4-year-olds who were in some cases reading better than average 8- or 9-year-olds, which showed that mentally they have no problems.
Yes.
They have incredible potential.
Yeah.
The same thing with the little Down syndrome children as well. They're principally also injured in the midbrain. If we get them young enough, they have no cortical problems.
Yeah.
But when we get them at 6, 8, 10 years of age, where basically they have been deprived, they haven't had the same experiences that average children have.
Yes.
So then we diagnose them as having a cortical injury because they're not understanding their environment at age level as they should be.
No, I'm really so happy to be at this time, in point in time, where actually parents and even teachers are starting to question the traditional methods of assessing intelligence, understanding children. Because I remember, Douglas, that I really had a hard time because my handwriting was bad. And because my handwriting was bad...
You were going to become a medical doctor.
You know, I now have 5 degrees and a PhD as well. But, you know, but if I had believed my teachers, because I remember when I was writing an exam, my invigilator, she came and she said, the way you are writing, you are going to fail in your exam because nobody can even understand. That really affected me. But I think, you know, if I had believed that, then I couldn't have gone ahead and be interested in academia. But, you know, what you are saying is it's very important for parents and people to recognize that intelligence is different from the skills based on which we assess someone's intelligence.
Right. And if we just go back to the anticonvulsant medications.
Yeah.
We've been doing the detox for 50 years, but now there have been studies after studies showing the IQ of these children is made less because of the medication. So here's a child being called mentally retarded,
yes,
being drugged legally, where the drug has been proven to lower his IQ, when the whole plan has to be to increase his intelligence so that he can compete with average children. So, of course, that's another good reason to get rid of the drug.
Yeah. So, I mean, that again comes back to what you were saying before, is that there's no point treating the symptoms. Yes, of course, the symptoms can be alarming, like epilepsy, but anti-epileptics is not the only solution if you're looking at development. So,
And I'm sorry to interrupt, but I have to say to the listeners who have children who are on the anticonvulsant medications that under no circumstances should they try to stop the drugs.
Of course.
That has to be done under the direct supervision of a medical doctor. Our protocol has to be followed by our medical staff to do this correctly.
Absolutely. It's one thing to understand the principles behind how brain works or how medical drugs work, but as you know, you take parents through an extended period of training them, guiding them how to support their children. So obviously, to implement any of these, it needs to be under supervision from experts who understand how it works. Yeah, that's very important for everybody to know, because in a world where today we have all these information that's available on the internet and self-prescribing practices, sometimes just based on information, people might think, yeah, they can stop something or start something else. But tell me a little bit more about how you support parents in helping their babies and children.
Well, the first thing, you know, we haven't discussed this, but this is maybe 50% of the entire problem is with the diagnoses. Mm-hmm. When you're talking to the parents of brain-injured children, they will say, oh, my child is not brain-injured. My child has cerebral palsy, or my child is autistic, or my child is Down syndrome, or my child has learning disabilities, mm-hmm. or my child is hyperactive, or my child has ADHD, or AD, and then you get into all the new letters that have been made, or my child is epileptic.
Yes.
So all of these diagnoses, and to tell you, you know, in terms of some of our research, of the 25,000 brain-injured individuals that we have been a part of their development, we have never thrown out a single clinical or medical chart. We have the biggest archives in the history of the world of with brain-injured people. And just one research done years ago, we went and looked at the admitting diagnoses of our patients, mm-hmm. and we counted more than 309 admitting diagnoses. Now, all of these people we found to have neurological problems and to be brain injured. Mm-hmm. And the diagnoses were things as such as lazy eye. I mean, the eye cannot be motivated. It cannot be lazy. Lazy esophagus was another admitting diagnosis, as if the esophagus can be lazy.
Has decided to be lazy.
So so parents are confused because they have been told your child is autistic, your child is cerebral palsy, and they don't realize that their child's problem is in the central nervous system and that it's brain injury, and the only way to solve that problem is to develop the brain itself. Mm-hmm. So we have been fighting a battle to get rid of all of those diagnoses and just tell it like it is. These children have brain injury. And you see, the industry for brain-injured children has not caught up with the research in neuroscience. Dr. Green, the medical director emeritus of the institutes, in a lecture last May, began the lecture with a huge medical book. It must be been 1,500 pages long. And the name of the book is Brain Injury. That's right. The term that we have been fighting for for 60 years. It's brain injury. So here is a medical book using brain injury, but still all of those societies for autistic kids, Down syndrome kids, yes, hyperactive kids, they all are out there, and it creates smoke and confusion for parents,
yes,
and for professionals as well, because they build in, they've bought into that whole diagnosis thing.
Right, yeah, because the way we look at a situation or condition is how we go about resolving that or addressing that situation. And obviously, terminology has a huge impact on how anybody responds to it. So my question to you, Douglas, is if we are, say, hypothetically looking at a case of autism or a person with autism, of course, you know, there can be obsessive compulsive disorder, emotional issues, behavioral problems, issues around nutrition, and health issues related to autism. But from your philosophy or your perspective, how would you see these characteristics of autism, and how do you go about addressing these?
Well, all of our research indicates that these children are injured in the posterior areas of the midbrain and the cortex. Mm-hmm. So the posterior areas being the sensory areas of the midbrain and the cortex. And of course, we knew this 50 years ago, but it's now well understood that these children have problems processing auditory information. Okay. That's why we've had an auditory stimulation program for more than 50 years, so that they can hear properly. How can they speak words if the brain has not recorded the sounds of those words in their brain in the first place, because their brain injury stops them from being able to do that? And of course, our children are hypersensitive from an auditory standpoint. Sometimes they're hyposensitive as well. And this leads to problems of understanding.
Yes.
You know, it's these children, you know, they'll be confused as having psychological problems. Mm-hmm. A child screams for no reason. Yeah. Well, there is a reason. Why does the child scream?
Yeah.
Well, he screams because he's hyper and auditory, and the air conditioner unit, you know, 25 meters away from us in the building turns on.
Yeah.
You and I can't hear that. The child can hear it, and it actually hurts his ears, so he screams.
Right.
And then, miraculously, he stops screaming because the compressor on the air conditioner, you know, turned off.
Yeah.
And, you know, the children also can hear lights. You know, fluorescent lights have a sound, and in some cases, they're hyper, that sound hurts their ears, so their behavior appears bizarre. No.
Yes.
They're hearing things that hurt their ears and make them behave badly.
Yeah.
The way you and I might do if we were in a car in a crowd that was chaotic and loud enough, you know, to, it would be hurting our ears.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And what do you have to say about digestive symptoms? You know, often children with brain injury tend to have digestive issues. They tend to have more food intolerances. Is there a pattern that you have seen amongst children where they are sensitive to some specific kinds of foods?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's well before it was, you know, mainstream understanding that gluten can be a problem for children. We had taken gluten out of the diet of our children, as long as dairy as well, and other foods that the children can be very sensitive to. So at the beginning of our program, there are basic foods that are removed. And then once the child is on an excellent diet, then we'll rotate back some of the foods where instead of them having it 7 days a week as they were having it before, they may have it 1 or 2 days a week with 3 days in between, so that they don't have the same food, which then they'll end up getting sensitive to.
Mm-hmm. So, Douglas, you know, gluten is an interesting thing because a lot of people now have an awareness about gluten. Of course, you know, 20 years ago, we would have said gluten is a problem only if someone has a diagnosable celiac disease. Whereas now we understand actually there's non-celiac gluten sensitivity. And people understand gluten is also closely related to the thyroid. But what I'm interested is, from your perspective, what's the relationship between gluten and brain?
Well, all of these things, when the children are sensitive to them, as you mentioned, it can create digestive problems, and it can lower their immune system, so they're prone to colds and ear infections and all kinds of illnesses and things. One of the victories we have, victories are significant changes that brain-injured children make on our program, but a health victory, for a brain-injured child to get a health victory, he or she has to have 12 consecutive months of perfect health,
right?
No fever, and no illness, no colds, no stuffy nose or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just going back to last week, we saw a four-year-old brain-injured child who has not been sick in 24 months. Now, you show me an average four-year-old child who
yes.
hasn't been sick.
Yeah.
And, you know, pediatricians in the U.S. are not concerned if an average child has 8 or 9 illnesses a year. They're not concerned. That's normal.
Yes.
Well, it's not normal.
But, yeah.
When brain-injured children can go 24 months from a 2-year-old to a 4-year-old with perfect health, it means that, you know, our standards have really become very low.
Right, yeah. And, you know, you mentioned before about cow's milk. Tell me a bit about cow's milk. I'm sure, you know, there are many cultures where once they start supplementing, cow's milk is often the choice for babies. So would you like to explain a little bit more about what are the things that parents need to understand about cow's milk if their children have brain injury?
Well, I mean, it's just as important to us that the children stop gluten as they stop dairy products as well. And, you know, I mentioned to you before that, you know, we have some children that the last day they had a dairy product was the last time they had a seizure.
So any type of dairy, is it cheese and goat's milk, sheep's milk?
Well, principally cow's milk.
Cow's milk, okay.
When the parents stop that, the child never, ever had a seizure again from that time. So it's a powerful thing, obviously, if it can create or help to create a seizure.
So is it something to do with casein, which is found in cow's milk, that might be causing the hypersensitivity?
I'm sure. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why the nutritional staff does that. You know, a story that your listeners might find interesting, you know, in our work with brain-injured children, when we learn that they have the potential not just to be average, but they have the potential to be above average intellectually, physically, socially, and physiologically. So if they have that potential, that is, of course, our objective for them. And so often we look to great experts that have gone way above average human abilities to see if we can learn from them and then apply that information to brain-injured children. Well, one of the Institute's friends and supporters is Novak Djokovic, the great tennis player.
Yes.
And Novak, in his book, wonderful book, you know, he is Serbian, but he speaks 5 languages.
Right.
And he wrote his book in English. And I've written books in English. It's not easy.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine doing it in a foreign language. But in his book called When to Serve, he explains his personal story where he rose to being the 3rd best tennis player in the world. But he would have attacks during heavy matches, mm-hmm. And would lose. And it was, you know, it was said that, you know, he was just weak. He just couldn't do it.
Yes.
So he took dairy and gluten out of his diet.
Mm-hmm.
And within 3 months, he became number one in the world. And he said it was like a fog coming off of his brain, that he could see and feel and, you know, perceive the world better just taking these things out of his diet. And, you know, and his energy levels greatly expanded. He yeah. became number one in the world and stayed there and, you know, is still at the top right now.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes it's the simplest of nutritional changes that people make can have a huge positive impact. And Douglas, you mentioned that the development of the brain is from the time baby is born, of course, you know, during pregnancy as well, to the age of 6, and that's quantitative. And after that, it's qualitative. What about, you know, those children or even adults who have brain injuries? Can they be supported as well through this program?
Absolutely. There is no age limit for anyone on the Institute's program. You know, we'll accept people of any age. The oldest recent person that I can consider was a gentleman in his early 70s,
mm-hmm.
a PhD in biochemistry, who had a stroke.
Right.
And so what is necessary in our program, there have to be loving members of the family who will help carry out the program. So this gentleman's wife and son came together as a team mm-hmm. To treat him. So there are no age limitations. We had the very famous Yoichi Fukunaga, the number one jockey in Japan many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
He was thrown from his horse during a race, was stepped on by the horse alongside of him, profoundly brain injured, in a coma, which is as profound a brain injury as you can
yes.
get.
Yeah.
And his wife and his father-in-law, who was also his horse trainer, did our program with him until Fukunaga was able to get back on a horse again.
Right.
And his son, who was raised as a well child on our program, is now one of the top jockeys in Japan.
So age is not a limit. Are you saying that neuroplasticity is possible at any age?
Well, this is a word that is, of course, in neuroscience, in the last 10 years, neuroplasticity is the big word, the
yes,
big,
it's a buzzword.
Exciting word. But the question is, what is being done about it?
Mm-hmm.
Now, every parent of a brain injured child who came to the institutes 60 years ago, 50 years ago, was taught that the human brain grows by use. The brain grows by use. And so our whole intensive treatment program is about teaching parents how they can arrange for their brain injured child to use their brains from the time they get up in the morning until the time they go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody on our program knows the brain grows by use. Well, if I can translate the term neuroplasticity, it means the brain grows by use.
So use it.
So there's nothing new about neuroplasticity at the institutes. Mm-hmm. That's what we've been doing. Mm-hmm. And of course, now there's another word, neurogenesis.
Yes.
And of course, medical doctors for generations have been taught that when a brain cell is dead, it is dead. There is nothing you can do about it. Of course, I think there are still medical doctors who believe that,
mm-hmm.
That they haven't learned that, no, neurogenesis occurs in human beings, in little children, and in 80-year-olds as well.
Wow. So that's actually something which is really cutting edge. Because, you know, in medical schools, that's what you're basically taught, that one cell that can never regenerate once it's dead is nerve cells. But what you're saying is, no, that may not be true.
No, no, it's not being, it has been proven okay. in human beings
that it is.
In the hippocampus that new cells pop into place, you know, regardless of our age.
So even in neurological pathologies, as in advanced age, you know, like maybe stroke and other conditions, are you saying that it is actually possible to some extent to modify the pathology?
Well, I mean, there are many different ways that the brain grows, not just neurogenesis. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is the better oxygenation of the brain.
All right.
And so the better the brain is oxygenated, the better that it will function. The actual cells themselves can grow. That's brain growth. Of course, the axons and the dendrites, the connections between the cells, they can grow. Mm-hmm. So these things are all a part of what's happening to our brain injured children. The neurotransmitters that permit the cells to communicate, of course, they can develop better, permitting the cells to communicate better. So these are all aspects of brain growth and development.
This is highly interesting, Douglas, and we are almost coming to the end of our episode. So I'd like you to share with my listeners where they can find more information about your program, what they can expect, and where your centers are.
Yes, well, of course, I'm happy to do that. So the number one thing is to go to our website, IAHP.org. The Institute has a huge website with lots of information and resources for parents. The next step would be to read the book, What to Do About Your Brain-Injured Child, which my father wrote. But don't be turned off by the word child. If you're talking about a brain-injured 15-year-old or 30-year-old, the book is just as applicable. And my father explains that our work began with brain-injured adults, not with children. So it works just as well with adults as it works with children. Mm-hmm. And then the next step, we have the first online program in the history of the world for the parents of brain-injured children. So this online program has on our website, has a free access with introductory lectures for free. And then enrolling in the program, there is a physical program, an intellectual program, and a nutritional program for the parents. So that can be done all around the world at, you know, very little cost. And then the next step would be our intensive 5-day course, the What to Do About Your Brain and Your Child course, which we do all over the world. A team of clinical staff and medical staff travels with the course. Mm-hmm. So that course will be in Philadelphia in Delhi in March.
In India.
Yes, in India. But our courses are highly oversubscribed in India. So the course is quickly filling up. If a family wants to come, I think it's March 18th in Delhi. Mm-hmm. At the Lalit Hotel, and then we'll have the course in Philadelphia in April, and then we'll be back here in Europe in July, and teaching the course in our center in Tuscany, in Italy, in English, Italian, Spanish, and Russian.
Wow, fantastic. This has been a really interesting conversation with you, Douglas. And
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living. We've been doing this for over 40 years. Every year, more and more people are living satisfying lives completely cruelty-free. Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.